You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I wanna be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I wanna be a producer.
Hey everybody, Ken Davenport here. Before we get to this week's podcast, if you're listening to this on iTunes, hey, do me a favor, give us a big 5-star rating, will ya? Let's spread the word about theater and all these awesome guests. Thanks so much.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, Producers Perspective podcast listeners. Welcome back. I am Ken Davenport. We've got another first here on the podcast today. The first time we've ever had two guests for the price of one. I'm proud to welcome to the podcast the Tony and Emmy nominated songwriting team of Pasek and Paul. Welcome, guys.
Hey, hello. Thank you.
So I've been lucky enough to have some incredible musical theater legends on this podcast, from Tim Rice to Lynn Ahrens to Stephen Schwartz. And I thought it was time to get some new blood up in here. So Benj and Justin have been called the next generation of musical theater songwriting superstars by just about every publication out there. But it's hard to think of them as rookies, considering they already have a Tony nomination on the wall for A Christmas Story. They've written for Smash. They had Dogfight off-Broadway at Second Stage. And this year they're going back to Second Stage with the highly anticipated Dear Evan Hansen. So guys, I'm going to start with a big question.
Uh-oh.
When Time Out New York says you will shape the future of the theater, or Vanity Fair says you're the heirs of Rodgers and Hammerstein,
it gives my mom a lot of ammunition at her synagogue.
Yes.
And we text Lin-Manuel and say, it's on you, bro.
So seriously, what does it feel like when you read this stuff? Is it a lot of pressure? Does it make you feel good?
I don't know. I think we try to not think about it, because I think if we do think about it, it definitely is a lot of pressure. Obviously, it's so nice that, you know, at least a couple of people with pens believe that. But I think that we, you know, we are excited to be... You talked about some of the other people who have been on this podcast, and I think that we feel very honored to be part of, you know, the generation of writers that we're in, and to be in this sort of history of writers, some of whom you mentioned. Lynn Ahrens, for instance, was one of our mentors. And so... I think we feel very tiny in this world of great writers, and so That's how I feel. I don't know.
Yeah, we had a professor. We went to University of Michigan is where we met, and we had a professor there who told us, like, if you believe anything good about you, you have to believe everything bad about you, too. And there have been lots of things that people have said that have been terrible about us. Yeah. I remember I used to read things online, like someone called us past suck and appalling once. I was like, oh, that's going to stick.
Creative.
So, you know.
Very creative.
Pretty creative. That, a lyricist suck. Must have come up with that one. So I think, you know, we kind of have adopted the philosophy that, like, it's really nice if people like what we do and other people will hate what we do.
Like it, yeah.
And, like, you know, we kind of just have to figure out for ourselves whether we like it or not. And that's really the barometer. And just try to hold to that.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we'll go back to the easy questions. So
yeah, I know. Yeah. At the beginning, Ken said, he's like, I'm going to give you some nice, easy questions to start. And then you just really threw a fast response curveball there.
I'm like Borat. Ali G. So you mentioned where you met. Tell me the story of how you guys found each other.
Yeah, we went to the University of Michigan, and we went as musical theater majors. So we were aspiring Broadway performers when we started college. And we became really good friends because we were the two worst members of the University of Michigan, certainly the musical theater department in dance classes in particular. So we are really not very coordinated guys. And we didn't really know that we should have taken, you know, any kind of dance class before
we
got there.
Yeah, we were definitely like the two people who didn't realize, like, that was like, I just didn't know that, like, dance class is particularly not to be whatever about it, but, like, I didn't know that, like, there were a lot of guys that took dance class, like, growing up. Then we got to school, and there were all these amazing dudes who were, like, leaping across the floor. I was like, we're like, wait a second.
Well, they all showed up the first day, like, in tights.
In tights.
And we were
in, like, sweats.
And
we were like,
this is a problem. Yeah. We became friends because we would, like, hide behind each other when we had to do the across the floors. And we couldn't remember any of the terms, like, the pot of shahs, that's the cat one, and the chevals. So we would, like, know when to leap by sort of whispering to each other while hiding behind each other, run a little bit, and then just jump and just, like, fly into the air. And hope that, you know, we would, like, catch each other when we fell. And
we were in the musical theater program there, and then we became friends that way. And then we sort of started just sort of messing around writing, not really intending to do anything.
Our freshman year.
Yeah, our freshman year. And we were sort of, you know, there's all the practice rooms at college. And so we, like, it always sometimes turns into a sing-along with all the musical theater majors.
A lot of seasons of love happening, a lot of riffs.
Yeah, just a lot of unnecessary riffing happening. Yeah. But we sort of started writing by accident, just a couple of things together. And then our sophomore year, we sort of decided, well, you know what it was, is our sophomore year, we were rising, you know, it's like, okay, here's going to be the moment. It was our second semester of sophomore year. We're like, we're going to start getting some roles. We're going to start, like, you know, becoming the performers that we're meant to be. And the second semester of our sophomore year, the show was City of Angels, our school show. And we were like, okay, we're going to, like, let's see what happens. And we both got cast as, like, terrible roles.
I got cast as the man with camera. That was my actual role. So I came on stage and I took a photograph and then I left. And Justin was cast as Harlan Yamato, the Asian backup dancer / coroner. So it was like our moms were flying
out.
And
for all you who are just listening, which is everyone, this is
Justin looks like...
This is not...
I say this as a nice Jewish boy. He looks like an Aryan and it's sometimes very scary. So he should not be playing an Asian backup dancer / coroner.
Yes. It was a different age.
Yes.
Michigan's so white now.
Yeah.
Watch out.
Exactly. So at that moment, we were like, okay, let's maybe reevaluate some things here. And we decided to write a show because we thought, well, that's something that we could do and maybe we'll be better at, maybe not, but we'll give it a try.
Certainly than dancing.
So we wrote a song cycle because that was sort of like the thing to do at that time, because every, you know, revered composer had written a song cycle. So we were like, we'll write our song cycle. So we wrote a show called Edges that was in college, and everything sort of started from there.
Yeah.
So you sit down and you write a song cycle. Well, it's like that easy.
No, we just wrote a song cycle. You know, it was songs. Most of the songs in that show, in that review, are sort of all thematically linked to really general things like who am I, who do I want to be. It's like all the very overly dramatic things you're grappling with, but they're very real to you at the time as 19 or 20 year old, which is like, you know, what kind of person am I? Everyone breaking up, having relationship woes.
We're just looking at our friends and basically putting them in song, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think the way that we approached it too is because we were studying as actors, and this is the way that I think we sort of got into it. We were taking classes about what makes a song theatrical. So we were learning the basics of what an actor needs to use to approach material. So like the basics of who am I talking to in the song? What do I want? What are the different tactics that I'm going to employ? And so we thought, okay, well, if we were to bring a song that we wrote into our acting class,
our acting teacher would ask us those things.
So how do we do it in reverse? How do we put those things into the song when we start and make it really easy for actors to approach it? And so I think our acting training, and particularly our acting through song at Michigan,
that was sort of our access point.
Yeah, it's how we sort of began writing.
What was the first song that you wrote together? You remember?
The first one is this random song called Classical Prose, which is like a pop song it's crazy. But the first song that we ever wrote that was theatrical, it's almost sort of as a joke, the lyric initially, because we were like, you know, all of these songs that like young guys at auditions sing, it's all just like about like, you know, boys with dreams, you know, let's just write a song like about like a boy with dreams. And so we called the song Boy with Dreams. And we're like, okay, like that's
sort of like the sort of like template sort of title of that sort of song. We just literally wrote a song called that.
Yeah. So it's about a boy who's like an aspiring,
working in a rural town at a pizza hut
who wants to be an inventor. Yeah. And that was the first song that we wrote that was theatrically minded.
So tell me a little bit about the process, whether it's then or mm-hmm. now, when you guys, okay, I've come up with an idea. It's Boy with Dreams.
Or maybe
who does, who does what? Who does what first? How does that, do you do it all together?
I mean, it's sort of, I think a big part of our process at least is, and it, you know, it does evolve and it keeps evolving and it has evolved. But it's changed in some way, for better or worse. But you know, we start by talking a lot. It's really a big discussion about what the song wants to be, what the song wants to accomplish, what the character is saying, and then often like a musical impulse, a style, an energy or a rhythm will come out of that. But a lot of it is the discussion of what the moment wants to be and what the big theme is. Is there a hook phrase? Is there a hook idea that can take us through the whole journey of the song?
We think of it almost like a five paragraph essay that you had to write in high school. Like, what is your thesis statement? Because that's what your chorus has to come back to. That has to support this one idea to make it something that sort of sticks in your head. So we find what is the phrase or what is the thesis statement that can be a unique enough angle that we can keep coming back to again and again and approach from, you know, from different angles.
Right. And then from there, then like maybe I'll start working on a musical idea, a way to musicalize that. Sometimes we'll just start with a chorus idea and get that and then work backwards. Or the only way in is just to go chronologically through the song and start it where it wants to start and then write it as we go.
Yeah, sometimes we write songs together in the room. Sometimes we divvy up and like I'll work on a lyric separately and then I'll send it to him or he'll work on music separately. But we try to be as intertwined as possible so that it feels as much as one voice as
possible. Yeah, I mean, what we're doing, there's a lot of strengths to being in a team, but like ultimately we're trying to do one person's job, really, which is like conceive a song, because it's not music and lyrics, it's like a song. So like we're trying to get as close to, you know, the one creative impulse as possible, which is like the music and the lyrics happen together, they're of the same voice, and so that's what we're trying to work toward.
And a lot of great songwriters talk about this, you know, particularly like Sondheim in his book, like you can't have a lyric without music. It's not just that you're reading it independently. So much of what we would write is dependent on what the musical impulse is going to be, or so much of the musical impulse is going to be dependent on what the, you know, the lyric would say. So it really is a fine marriage in the way that both have to support each other. And we really try to write it with one voice.
So you write this song cycle, and I remember hearing about it myself, even here, thousands of miles away from, or a thousand or whatever miles away from Michigan. How did you get the attention for it that you did? So you finish it, and you're like, hey, we wrote a song cycle. Then what was your impulse?
We were really lucky in that it's sort of like the Malcolm Gladwell Outliers book, where he talks about just timing is everything for certain things to be able to have nice lives. And for us, this Edges show, and for our careers, we were very lucky because we wrote this in 2005 when we were sophomores in college. And that was a year after Facebook had just come out and the year that YouTube had come out. And so we were able to have this material that was really about being a 19 or 20-year-old at the time. And we were able to connect with other 19, 20, 21-year-olds who were still in college. And for the first time, without needing to have a production anywhere else in the world, you could immediately have access to or see material right away digitally. So I wouldn't need to necessarily put up a show in New York and then wait for a cast album to be created. And then a few months or years later, it gets disseminated. Yeah. I can write a song right away and have a 19-year-old hear that song at Carnegie Mellon or at Boston Conservatory.
Right.
Or
I mean, the way it happened Webster initially University. Is people at other schools that we were connected to through friends said, oh, you know, we recorded a CD. That was like the important thing. We got a little bit of money donated from some supporters of the musical theater program there and recorded a CD with our cast at school, and that got around to a few other schools. And they said, hey, could we do the show at our school? But, and we were like, whoa, that's a crazy concept.
But part of that also was because at the time, you could look at other musical theater majors who you could see college majors on Facebook. Right. So we would look up who was a musical theater major at Carnegie Mellon.
I think that was that sort of came from first a few other schools said, we would love to do this. And then we were like, oh, so maybe other musical theater schools would be interested in this. So then we were able to reach out on Facebook.
And we would literally just write people at Boston Conservatory or wherever it was and say, hey, like, if we have a song cycle, would you be interested in doing this thing? And from that,
or vice versa, people could reach out to us because they heard from their friend at Baldwin Wallace that they did something, they want to do something in Cincinnati, or
and this sort of new Wild West of social connectivity allowed us to connect with the people who might appreciate what we were doing, and without any of the lag time of having to have a full production to be able to have it heard for the first time. So within a year of us creating this, I think we already had maybe something like 20 productions at different colleges by the time that we were juniors. And from that,
I think that's then helped. That somehow got word of that. Word of that got to New York. And so we had someone produce a cabaret of our songs at Joe's Pub. Like, you know, that whole track of doing stuff at Joe's Pub and Ars Nova. And through connections of Michigan, a lot of them, we had Gavin Creel come and sing songs for us. And Staley Keenan Bulger. And I don't remember who else. But Dan Reichard came, like, you know, a lot of Michigan people, and they bring their friends. So Steve Pasquale came. So it was sort of this like concurrence of events that sort of like led to it, us seeming like we were doing more than we actually had done. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, they must be. We're like, we haven't done it. It's just like this. It was a very interesting time for all these things converging. Well, being able to reach out through Facebook, chat boards happening, you know, all that stuff happening at the same time. And so we were able to, I think, get a little kickstart in New York before coming to live there.
Did you realize you were like acting as like incredible marketing directors for yourself and for your show when you're like, I'm going to sit down and develop a market. I'm going to write to all these people.
I think that we just, you know, thought, well, these people would enjoy it. And, you know, like, we want the show produced. We weren't really thinking like, how do we market? It wasn't
right.
That.
But it was also like at the same time, strategy, our friends were getting, you know, Andrew Keenan Bulger is one of our classmates. And he and another one of our classmates, Jake Wilson, like, they were creating online video content. And like, it was, and they were putting videos of their dance workshop at school online. And this was like a foreign idea. You know what I mean? It's like kids putting musical theater stuff on YouTube. And then developing a web series app from it. Like, it was, they were all doing the same sort of thing. So whatever that idea came from, it sort of caught around our friends. And so everybody started putting their stuff online. It was really the first time that was.
Well, YouTube was invented in 2005, and we were doing it in 2005. So it was really this very natural, organic way to put the material that we were writing out into the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And then naturally, other people saw it, and it, you know, disseminated. Yeah.
Do you think it's as easy for college sophomores today to do the same thing?
I think it's not as easy only because there's just a lot more content now. Like, now that's a standard thing. You know what I mean? At that point, it was very novel.
Yeah.
Now it's like everybody has their songs on YouTube. Everybody has their sheet music up for sale. Everybody, you know, like, that was
new at the time. Yeah.
That, it was very new at the time. So it was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Now, I mean, blessedly, I think now, like, musical theater, like a wildfire, sort of, it just exists. Like, at that time, it was like it felt like the remnants, you know, of people who were like survived the you know, there's the old members of the church who like held on to, you know what I mean? And they're like, we're here, yes, we're out here. Oh, you're putting stuff online, like, yes, we want that. Now it's like, awesomely, everyone around the country has access to it. And there's ever since then, there's been Glee. There's been all the live musicals. I mean, now it's sort of a mainstream thing, which is great. It probably makes it harder for like someone to emerge from all of that because there's a lot more content.
Yeah.
But it's...
But I will say...
It's good for all of us.
Compared to what I imagine living in New York or trying to emerge here would have been 15 years ago, there's more of a democratization, you know, that I don't necessarily need a producer to approve and give me a production here in New York to get my material heard. So it really,
ultimately,
I think that writers are right to have if you want that production.
Right.
But ultimately, I think that writers can view themselves more as entrepreneurs than they ever were able to before. And they almost have to be able to launch themselves because they're competing with other people that are acting as entrepreneurs. And that's the way that, you know, you initially will launch. So thinking in that way, I think, has been very beneficial and now becomes sort of necessary, I think, as new music theater writers.
It's a very Ken Davenport conversation.
That's why I
right?
asked the question.
It's obviously true. I mean, it's one of the reasons I wanted you guys on the show. I'm a big believer that artists need to think like entrepreneurs,
yeah.
whether they know they're thinking like entrepreneurs.
Right,
I mean,
right.
You two are a very unique group because you have it naturally within you. I mean, that's why I asked that question. You didn't know you were marketing, but that's exactly what you were doing. You
right.
were acting as the CMO of your
right.
partnership, which is really incredible. So you get here, you've made, you know, a name for yourself before you even get here. You get here, and then what was the first show? Was it James and the Giant Peach that you did first? Was it Christmas Carol that you were attached to first? Which
we did. Those were sort of back to back.
I'll say when we first got here, we thought because we had already written a song cycle, people were going to hire us for jobs, and so we were like, oh well, you know, we would have these meetings. You know, we had an agent.
It was awesome. We got an agent.
Right.
We came to the city. We were like, okay, the path is clear.
And we would go on these meetings with people who wanted to have like a general meeting. Nice to meet you. And they were like, okay, so you know, what show are you? Talk about shows, and we were like, well, we have one, it's this song cycle, and are you gonna hire us to write your next one? And they were like, no, that's just not how it works. And so I think we were waiting a long time, even though we had sort of been entrepreneurial early on. When we first got here, we were waiting for people to give us opportunities,
right.
and that sort of yielded very little for us.
Yeah.
And so we had to, I think, then begin to initiate
yeah,
things
projects.
Again.
And, you know, as soon as we then started to write things, then other things did come to us. But, like, it took us being like, we need to create a project ourselves. And that was when we started writing Dogfight. But the first thing that sort of happened, I think the chronology was that James the Giant Peach was the first thing that we ever did.
It was produced first.
It was produced first. And that was back-to-back in the fall with that. And then Christmas Story.
This was in 2010.
Yeah.
Even though we had started Dogfight in 2008.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
James the Giant Peach happened at Goodspeed Opera House. And it was a total disaster. And then
it was our first time ever having a professional show, and,
yeah.
and we did not know what we were doing.
Yeah,
and it reflected
were,
it on stage.
Yeah, it was a good hard first lesson to learn. And like everybody has to be making the same show, and then to have all those conversations beforehand, and there was a lot of crazy wacky events that led to it just not, you know, having the success we hoped it would have. You know, thankfully, or you know. We sort of were able to jump right from there to Christmas Story, which was happening in Seattle at the Fifth Avenue, and that was sort of the first step on that show's path.
And since then, James the Giant Peach, we have gone back and retooled it and,
yeah.
and refocused it, and we're really happy with it now. But the first production of it was left more to be desired.
Yes.
And what do you think, if you could say like one thing you would do differently about James and the Giant Peach? What's the one thing that you think you
I think
do?
We needed more time in development before we put it up in front of an audience.
Yeah.
And you know, we didn't really realize how difficult it would be to change things once a show has already been teched and is already, even if it's
on
in
stage.
A preview process, when it's already on stage, it's very, very difficult to, you know, cut half of a song out, or, you know, there can be entire transitions that you're like, oh, well, this character should enter. Oh, well, that character can't because they're already getting ready for the tap number in Act Two, so they have to put tap shoes on during that time. You know, if you think that out further in advance,
yeah, it's just
you're
like
able to make
really
those changes.
Careful planning beforehand.
Yeah.
And I think also with James the Giant Peach, it was like there were a bunch of amazing ingredients that were going into it that all sounded amazing, but like I don't think we ever stopped to think about how did they all agree and did they speak, were they all speaking the same language? So I think it was a good lesson in being like, just just because something sounds like it's going to be amazing, like you have to really think about, like, are these all working in tandem and working together to create the same show?
And I also think, you know, it was actually a fantastic experience. We worked with Palabolas on James and the Giant Peach.
And Graziella Daniele.
And Graziella Daniele. Yeah, it was like an amazing
incredible
first group of
team.
People. And Tim McDonald, who's a great playwright. But I think that sometimes we would sort of excuse not thinking through what should be dramatically happening in a moment, because we thought, well, Palabolas is magical. They'll make that moment magical. You know what I mean? Without being like, well, how are we going to tell them
what
to
are
make
we
that
doing?
Moment magical?
What are we doing?
And I think we would rely on other people's abilities sometimes and not give ourselves enough responsibility in storytelling.
In truth, we didn't know what we were doing. Yeah. You know what I mean? So,
but thank God we went through that experience because we learned a lot.
Right, exactly.
Well, it's very honest for you to admit that. So you obviously learned a lot from that, and you take it to A Christmas Story. Now, A Christmas Story, was it originally designed to go to Broadway?
No, it wasn't.
What was that like when you get that call from the producer, like, hey, guys,
well,
we're going to go to Broadway this year?
it was amazing. I mean, we did Christmas Story in Seattle in 2010, and then we had the great fortune of having it go on a national tour in 2011. And again, we thought that would be it, and like it would play these amazing, like the Fifth Avenue Theater we studied at the University of Michigan. Like we knew about like the seat capacity. You know what I mean? Like, we were like, oh my God, we're at the Fifth Avenue Theater. That was a big enough deal. And then it went to the Chicago Theater,
right.
And that was a huge deal. And then, you know, we found out that it was going to go to Broadway, and it was kind of inconceivable for us.
Yeah. I mean, it was never designed to do that. And so it was actually pretty much designed for like licensing. It was never intended to go to Broadway. So it was huge. I know a lot of it depended on how things went in Chicago, and things went well in Chicago.
So Chris Jones, the theater critic, I will love him for the rest of my life because I really give credit.
How audiences and critics responded in Chicago was really the thing that, because look, it's a huge risk to come to Broadway, and Christmas Story, for instance, it's like, next to him, it's impossible for it to even, you know, make back its money or anything like that. So it was really a show of faith and an investment in the future of the property for the producers to bring it, because, you know, playing on Broadway for 8 weeks, you can never recoup anything. It's basically just to cement the property. And like, you know, we never thought it would go to Broadway. We certainly didn't think our Christmas show that played for 8 weeks that we'd be going to the Tony Awards that year for, you know, because of that. So if you had seen what we were doing, like when we first found out about that job and started writing it, and flash forward to the Tonys, it's pretty hilarious.
We were at a production of Edges at Shorter University at the time in Georgia. Because we were like, oh, like, they're doing our show.
Yeah.
And I think, and embarrassingly, I say this as a gay man, we were eating at a Chick-fil-A time when we got the call.
That's right.
That's right. The Christmas Story, that they had hired us for Christmas Story. And back then, and we actually, I think it was because we were, like, foolish enough to do it, but we had to end up writing the entire show by that Christmas. We got this call in March, and they were like, okay, we need
to... So we start rehearsals at the end of September. We were like...
Cool.
Okay.
We'll do what we're doing.
You put down the chicken sandwich for
Diane and said, let's get to work.
Exactly. My first protest at Chick-fil-A was at that moment. Get out of here.
So you write James and the Giant Peach, a Christmas Story, and then in the midst of all this, you write Dogfight, which is something you've been working on for a long time, and now Dear Evan Hansen, which both of them are more difficult, challenging subject matters.
Oh, really, Ken?
So what attracts you to something and says, and I know Dear Evan Hansen is an original story of your own, right?
Yeah.
And Dogfight was obviously based on a movie, but what makes you, or what gets you attracted to a story and says, this one has to sing. Mm. This is one we want to do.
Yeah, you know, I don't, it's hard to figure it out because like, there are different things about each one. I'm not sure I can find a theme. Like with Dogfight and Dear Evan Hansen, it's sort of like against our better judgment in a way. I mean, it's like, I don't know why we're drawn to these sort of, I mean, I think that they're dark in different ways. And with Dear Evan Hansen, there's a lot of hope and redemption and comedy in the show as well. Dogfight is just sort of dark.
Well, but tell everyone what Dear Evan Hansen is about.
Yeah.
It's a little difficult to describe without, you know, no spoilers, but it's basically about a kid who is, I don't really know how to describe it.
It's about a kid who's in a high school and is very lonely and very isolated, and it's a very sort of common thing. I think people recognize a lot of
truth to this kid
in his character
in an overly connected digital world, right, where he feels more isolated than ever.
And maybe everyone in the play feels more isolated than ever, although very connected. And you know, something happens, sort of a tragedy happens in the school, and there's an opportunity for him to seem connected to the person who suffered this tragedy in a way that he wasn't really. And there's a lot of great healing benefit for everyone involved for him to seem connected. And so he seems connected.
Yeah,
and
he sort of perpetuates a lie that that allows a bunch of healing and allows him to become the person that he's always thought that he wanted to be.
And in a way, the person that we want him to be. We just don't want him to be it that way, but we so want him to become that person. And I think by the end of the show, he does become that person in a truthful, honest way. But I think it's a real examination of a couple of things. Obviously, our incredible isolation and loneliness as a culture right now, especially in a digital age. I think it's an examination of our odd need to feel connected to things, particularly tragedies.
We were both very inspired for this story because in high school, when the 9/11 attacks happened, we remember a lot of people fabricating their own involvement or knowing people that were involved in this great tragedy. You know, I knew friends that made up that they had an uncle who was, you know, in the tower, or like, it's crazy things. And it was so interesting to both of us, like, why was our generation like needing to be a part of something? And we sort of have examined, like, as we become more isolated than we've ever been before, this excuse to come together as a community by any means necessary is really real. And like, and to find
same
community.
It's like, you know, celebrity deaths and people sharing their story. It's like,
we're all claiming Robin Williams as our own, but like, were you really Robin Williams' biggest fan before he passed away? Or like, is this a moment that you can be noticed and be seen, you know?
And then like, both sides are authentic, you know, like both sides are real. Like, it is real that it's like, you know what, it's beautiful to share a tribute about someone and say, this was my moment, but it's also a little selfish, you know what I mean? Like, but the selfish act comes from a genuine need, like a genuine hole somewhere inside of us that needs to be filled.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that makes it sound very, very heavy.
There's lots of comedy,
you know,
too,
I mean, it's fun. Look, I mean, we have fun with it in the show, and it's not just dark. And, you know, our playwright, Stephen Levinson, is fantastic. And it's a very contemporary, humorous book. You know what I mean? It feels very indie filmic in a way, I would say. And I hope people come see it, and I hope people enjoy it. But I'm really excited about it.
I've been thinking about like why we wrote this story.
Yeah.
For me, at least, I think so much of Dogfight, but particularly Evan Hansen, it's like, it's about asking a question and trying to get to the answer of that question through the creation of something artistic. So like, I don't really know if I have the answer in myself, but I see a lot of myself in a lot of these characters, and so much of the plot and the songs have to do with me wrestling with, you know, my own identity or who I want to be as a human being or why I do the things that are a little dark and weird and scary, you know, even in my own head. And getting to explore that in a theatrical way is exciting. So, yeah.
You mentioned working with Stephen. So how do you guys work with book writers? What's the process there? You guys are a very tight team, obviously.
Yeah. Well, we do all the work, and then Stephen just puts... No, actually, it's the opposite. Stephen does all the work, and we just steal his ideas. That's what every great songwriter does, right? They just steal a great...
Don't tell the truth.
No, I mean, you know, we love Stephen, and we have our sensibilities, our artistic sensibilities, I think, are very aligned. Our senses of humor are very aligned. And we work pretty collaboratively.
We discussed because this is our first original story, or first original musical ever, we spent a very, very long time just developing the idea.
Yeah, our outline and just like the narrative structure was a very, very long process. And it was an idea that we had that we brought to Stephen, but he now, I mean, he owns it. It's really like he took the good parts of what we were suggesting and made them beautiful and discarded the crappy parts. And really created an exciting, I think, and compelling narrative. But we work, you know, really back and forth pretty fluidly. And he'll send us we're on the phone to him saying, hey, we feel like we need this moment. Like, can you shoot us a monologue for what this character is feeling? Or here's our monologue. Does it seem right for what the, for what we might musicalize? And it's pretty back and forth. But he's I mean, it's incredible because he's never written a book for musical before.
Yeah, and this is a really, I think, it's a really, really great book, particularly for a musical. And I think that anyone who sees it will just see he really, I think, shines more than we do
We felt he wrote the show. He pretty much did a pass early on once we'd done a lot of development as a play. And I read it. We read it, and it was like, this is really beautiful. I don't want to mess this up with songs. Almost.
We were almost like, should this be a musical piece? It's a really good play.
No, you know what? So then we sort of were like, okay, our job is to just like seamlessly take this from scene into song and back into scene again. And I think hopefully if we've achieved something, you know, that's what I'm maybe proud of. We'll see how, you know, how it ends up, but like
that it feels,
I think,
like
that's what we,
in the same way that
our
song.
Goal is to match his tone, really. It was to get inside those scenes and just take them into song and take them out of song and make it feel like we never stopped to sing. We never stopped to be like, oh, now they're turning on their musical theater voices and they're doing that, and now we're back on the scene. It's like he's capturing a very contemporary and relevant tone, and I think we sort of felt it was our job to meet him at that place.
And in the way that we talk about trying to write songs with one voice, now he's our third collaborator, I think we're trying to write the show as one voice.
Right.
So, you know, there's really hopefully a seamlessness between song and scene, and it really feels like it all could have come from one mind.
We're saying a lot of hopefully, we hope, if, you know, there's a lot of that kind of talk, because we're in the middle of rehearsals right now.
Yeah, we're hopeful right now. But wait till tech can. Good thing you didn't interview us in like 3 weeks. I would be on Klonopin.
Yeah.
Okay, one at a time. Greatest musical theater songwriting team of all time. Justin.
Oh my gosh. Well, see, this is
don't
hard.
Don't look at each other. You can't consult.
No, but see, it's hard because, like, can we do... Oh no, I don't even want to do it. Can we do... I was going to ask if we could do, like, Not Living.
Yes, of course. Of all time. Throughout history. You could do, you know, Plato, for all I care.
I mean... Songwriting team, though? I mean, like, the grandfathers, right? I would say Rodgers and Hammerstein. Like,
I would say, I'll say Bach and Harnack.
Very nice. Very different choices from the two of you.
Hey.
So I've been in New York City around long enough now where I've lived through a couple of... This is the new generation of musical theater. So I, you know,
we're trying to white knuckle
so
that
Ken's
title.
Like, are you really?
I was, you know, Jason Robert Brown was my vocal coach when I was at NYU.
Oh my gosh,
and
wow.
Handed
so
me
cool.
a song to sing.
Oh,
like, oh,
cool.
You should sing this song. And it was by Andrew Lippa. Like, so I've,
oh, fun. Yeah,
I've
yeah.
been around that crew. So who are your peers? Who is this, the group, your group now? Who are the people that
I feel like the well, people, you know, it's funny, we're
Bach and Harnack,
Rogers and
Sheldon will pay it.
Yeah, right. I know.
He's the coolest
he's cool
dude
at all.
Ever.
Are you kidding?
He's so cool.
I mean,
well, you know, we're part of this songwriting space,
sort of collective sort of thing
called Song Space, that this wonderful woman Kara Unterberg helped create, and so there's a lot of great writers in that. But I would say. Chris Miller and Nathan Tyson are writers that we really love.
The people that we, I feel like the first people I think of are the people that we all share a workspace together. And that list of people is Miller and Tyson. It's Adam Guan. It's George Stitt. It's
Brian
Lauerbach and Kate Kerrigan. It's Joe Kinnosh and Kellen Blair. It's Marcin Zina. And Hunter.
Oh yeah,
it's keep naming everyone.
And Koeman Diamond.
Yeah, Koeman Diamond.
And we, I guess we
I
love
don't know
Joe Iconis's
yeah,
work.
Yeah, yeah. But there's a lot. I mean, it definitely
you share
is,
a workspace.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
That's the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
It's really really cool.
And we like have a Google Calendar where we say like, oh, you know, are you? There's different rooms that you can rent, and it's great. So it's a nice thing, and it's really great because it's fostered a sense of community between all of us. So. You know, I think we used to look at each other across the room and be like, at like weird events and be like, oh, it's those guys. But now, you know, when we get frustrated, we sit in the room and complain together about how we can't find, you know, something that rhymes with orange. You know,
so 20 years from now, finish this statement. I know I will have had a successful career in the musical theater if...
Ken Davenport interviews me again.
Oh, God.
Dude, for real. Is that for real?
Mate, that could have been for real. I'll give another answer, though. I guess if we get to... This sounds corny, and I'm just thinking of it. I mean, this is not, like, planned answer, because I didn't know you were going to ask this. But I guess if we write stories that feel like they are only things that we could have written. I mean, what I'm really proud of about Dear Evan Hansen and Dogfight and you know, things that we're at least trying to put out into the world are things that we feel like we're not trying to imitate someone else's style, and we're trying to create things that only our weird, demented little minds would have come up with. And if we can kind of find things that feel authentic to us, and then because they feel really authentic to us, that translates to permeate other people's hearts and feel true to them, then I guess that's really my goal, that we're creating things that feel relevant and that move people, especially particularly in our generation, but that feel new and that they're authentically ours.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess on the I would agree with that. So I would echo that. And then I'd also say on like a practical sense, like it takes so much work, and not for the writers, I mean for everyone, work and you know, confluence of events and people and artists to create a show that plays on Broadway and runs on Broadway. It's like, it's magic in a way. It's lightning in a bottle, I feel like, and it so rarely happens, a show that like works in all those ways, that all 120 people or 270 people or however many it is in the orchestra, on stage, on the crew, all the designers, that are all speaking the same language at the same time or enough times throughout 2.5 hours that a show just works and runs, and the audience comes and sees it and comes and sees it again and tells their friends to come and see it. I think having a show that actually runs for like, you know, a
more
year.
Than 7 weeks.
More than 7 weeks. But I mean, like, you know, you think of they're the shows that have that can get out there and be there for a few years. It's like, okay, there's something. There's a big accomplishment, and you can criticize them, or you can say, oh, it's because of this, that, and the other reason. But the fact is, there's a story being told with songs that people are going to see. They're coming to see it again, and they're telling other people to come see it. So that is a huge accomplishment. It's something that I know that I would love, you know, yeah, in 20 years, be able to say, me and a bunch of other people did that and made that, and we pulled it off, and it was magic.
Yeah. Okay, last question. My James Lipton question. You ready?
Oh, yes.
I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin,
okay,
comes to your show song space, right? That's what
yes,
it's called.
Yes.
It knocks on the door and says, listen, you guys have done an amazing job already. You such self-starters. You developed the song cycle yourself. You got it here. And you've made such contributions already to the music. I want to thank you by granting you one wish. But just one. What drives you crazy about Broadway? What gets you angry? What keeps you up at night? What gets you so upset that you want this genie to wish it away or to change it with a snap of a finger?
That's a good question.
That's a great question. I mean, I don't know. There's nothing to... I mean, the thing that I always hear people complaining about is that it's just too expensive to go to Broadway, and so the only audiences that can see it are privileged audiences, and we're not bringing in new audiences to see shows. The flip side of that is it is so expensive to produce a show on Broadway that the only way to pull it off is to charge those prices, because if people are willing to pay them, you need to charge those prices, not just to make money, but just to be able to stay open and to keep the ship afloat. I don't know what... I couldn't wish for something because I don't know what the...
I don't know what the solution is. I mean, I would echo that as well, but I think it starts with even people who have access to musical theater have the privilege to be able to go to school to study musical theater. It's a very privileged world to be a part of, and I think that we both acknowledge that we have been very privileged to be a part of that world, and to be able to get a BFA in musical theater at the University of Michigan is, even at 18, already allows us to be able to think, how could I be a music theater writer in ways that I think other people don't have the opportunity to. So I think it's about, like, for me, I wish that so many other kinds of stories and kinds of minds that are different than mine were represented and would be able to have access to
see shows, to write shows.
Yeah. all and that we would get wildly different perspectives. And I think that's one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why Hamilton is so exciting, because it's a different perspective for Broadway. And you know, we have a friend, Lemon Anderson, who is a poet and has done shows with the public. And like, I know he's talked about how some of his own family and friends can't come and see his shows. And it's like, that's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah.
He has such a different experience. He grew up in Brooklyn, you know,
in the
late 80s. And like, not enough people have that perspective. And like, I want to hear that story, but there are not enough Lemons who are, you know, being able to create shows. So I don't know. I would wave a magic wand and
make it affordable for everyone. I mean, make it affordable for patrons, but also, I mean, the problem is people who just complain about the price of tickets. It's like, you have to understand, it is so expensive to do this, and
right.
It's such a crazy risk, and more than nine times out of ten, you're not going to make your money back anyway. So, like, yes, it's lovely to make it affordable for people, but they have to charge the ticket prices to
right.
be able to make money to keep
but
money
I mean,
afloat.
But, as much as we started, like, writing, you know, Edge's song cycle, and, like, people, like, responded to it, I mean, like, the kinds of problems that we're identifying in Edge's as 19-year-old kids are, like, really privileged
like,
problems.
I
want to
realize
to
my dreams. Not
yeah.
like I want to get through till tomorrow. You know what I mean? Like,
and
I want to survive the next week.
I think that, you know, so many of the people who end up writing and who end up in this industry do come from a level of privilege. And I wish that there was, in the same way that the internet has allowed for democratization of upstarts, you know, I wish that there was sort of a democratization of who was able to be able to create new material
and be represented on Broadway.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. You talk about the BFA and musical theater in general being a privileged
it is.
Opportunity. I'd love to see the ratio of sports scholarships to musical theater
yeah,
scholarships.
Yeah, right? No, really. Yeah,
totally.
That's so great answer. Thank you so much, guys, for
Thanks.
Doing this. Everyone out there, go see Dear Evan Hansen at Second Stage. Starts performances on March 26th, which means you guys got to get the F back to rehearsal right now.
See you later, Ken.
Check out their website, passingandpaul.com, and we'll see you on the next podcast. Tony Award-winning choreographer Chris Catelli.
Yay!
Oh,
yay!
He did Dogfight!
Yes, he did. Thanks so much, guys, and we'll see you next time, everybody.
Don't forget, if you're listening to this on iTunes, make sure you give the show a big, fat 5-star rating and throw in a comment or two as well. Let's get the word out about these great artists that give their time all for you. Thanks so much.
I'm gonna be a producer. Look out, Broadway. Here I
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.